This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Yeah, Frank here, he's got his own billiard room.
Yes, it's the...
billiard room.
Come on already. We call it the...
The Place to Be.
Yes, the Place to Be. The Place to Be.
Then I shall be there.
Now, it's time. Live and in living color.
The Grandy Man can.
Time to play the game!
No, you left me satisfied and smiling.
That's what she said!
Why do I want this? I want to make bank, bro. I want to get ass. I want to drive a Range Rover.
Place to Be Nation, Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be podcast.
Very nice, Mr. Criscola.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dennis.
Japanese band Oral Vampire produced a song called The Repo Man and used footage.
Oral Vampire, huh?
Or Aural. A-U-R-A-L.
What kind of show is this?
Sounds like some Twilight porn in Michael Vincent's collection there.
Oz went on to star in American Pie, of course, as the lacrosse player. Bismarck. No, was it Bismarck? Was that his
Lismarck.
Name? Lismarck. Lismarck. No, who's the other guy I'm getting confused with?
Bismarck. Yeah, he dressed as North Dakota.
There's only one place where the big butts play, and that is in my extra queen size bed. Well, it just happens. What can you do?
Let's talk the fix.
I think they might hit a shock wall.
Is that the Shockmaster's wall?
Yeah, I like Big Dick myself. I was just curious. PTB Nation, let me know what
you're
doing.
Our opener.
To do worse than Josh Richard.
Place to Be Nation! Welcome back to another great episode of the one and only Place to Be podcast. I'm your co-host, Just Rosero, coming at you live here on this Tuesday evening inside the PTB podcast studios. And joining me, as always, the man whose gimmicked penis is the same size as his real-life penis, as I heard in the testimony today, the Scott Criscola. Scott, how are you?
You're starting to get like those Vince's intros of Lord Alfred on TNT. It's gotten ridiculous.
That's pretty much your role, so.
Levi's jeans. Although I wish I had, you know, brown tuxedos and fucking purple and everything. JR, pleasure as always. Welcome, Place to Be Nation, to episode 397 of The Mothership. Yes, it is Tuesday. And been a while since you and I have done back-to-back weeks. Mm. But here we are on a Tuesday trying to catch up.
More of it coming. It's a month of Place to Be.
Well, it always is. March, April is always the busiest time of the year because it's the busiest time of the year in professional wrestling.
Yeah. Step closer to my dream of the marathon meet that we're going to do someday. Someday, when I can somehow schedule it with the wife, record every night.
It would be very interesting. Kind of like when Will does it, right? When he does like 11 straight WrestleMania podcasts. You had a good weekend, sir. Your bodyguard, a.k.a. Big Al.
Mm-hmm.
In the big Uno this
yes,
weekend,
did.
Huh? Yeah.
It was good. Yeah, I'm still gorging on the leftover cake like an asshole, but it just needs to go away, this cake. It's like this huge sheet cake left over, like half of it, and I find my way through it every night, so we just gotta dump it.
But ice cream, yellow cake, chocolate?
Yes, chocolate.
Chocolate. Very good.
Some frosting.
Oh, very nice.
It's delicious.
Very nice. Good.
So, we have so much leftover food, like we're still just eating it all.
So.
That was the St. Paddy's Day fiesta.
It was very good. Very good. 6,200 in
people
in our no. Oh. Yeah, I imagine.
Yes,
we had it. We had it at the Silverdome, brother. No, a little over 210 for the number of people, and made over 6,000 into our charitable funds. We thank everyone, and yeah, it was a good time. It was busy. So a chance to unwind on Sunday, and. We are getting closer, of course, to busiest month of the year for me, and that is, of course, the NCAA tournament. And we got a lot of those coming up, JR, of course, our big, what, seventh now? Or sixth?
Sixth or seventh, right? Sixth.
Sixth
11, 12,
annual.
13, 14, 15, 16. Sixth annual March Madness preview show.
Preview show.
Amazingly enough, like I said, we had the same crew. We had we'll have Rotella, we'll have Chris, we'll have Mr. Reich. The sixth straight year, the whole crew's been back. So
that's right. Yeah, we'll be pumped. So that'll be next week. But tonight, Tonight, a nostalgia show for you and I, because, yeah, this was the...
Hey, what is going on here?
I can understand you being freaked out, because we're usually not here on Tuesdays. I know it's parent-teacher night, parent-teacher nachos night. But tonight, JR, the final pay-per-view of the calendar year 2005. Again, a very kind of historic one for you and I, because it was our second ever live pay-per-view together. So tonight, inside the big steel box known as the Vintage Vault, we bring you Armageddon 2005.
Armageddon, excited to talk about this one.
Yes. Again, first pay-per-view that you and I were at together since WrestleMania 20. And, of course, we'll give you the background on how we got to the building that evening. But why don't we hop in?
Okay.
December 18th, 2005. Live from your office, my friend. The Dunkin' Donuts Center. Centre in Providence, Rhode Island. Of course, familiar with this building, JR. This is the, fourth pay-per-view. Ever in the building, third for you in the building.
Yeah.
However, the only thing I wanted to look up and ask you was, obviously, since the last time we were here on pay-per-view, which is way back at Backlash 99, the one Providence pay-per-view you were not at.
That's correct.
When did the sponsorship flip? When did it actually start? I don't know if you have that info in front of you. When did it actually change to the Dunkin' Donuts Center?
It was 2001. Naming rights deal with Dunkin' Donuts. And then in 2005, the Convention Center Authority purchased the building from the city and did a extensive renovation. So it slowly began where they did. They put in new LED video board. They put in a restaurant, luxury suites, bathrooms, and then eventually put in all new seats. And I remember that came a little bit later, I believe, because I'm trying to see if they have the date. Oh, yeah. Oh, wait. Because it was after I had already had my season, or at least had been going to PC Games.
Right.
Then they redid it. Because I remember originally the section we're in, all the seats went down to the bottom, and now they don't. We're over that little entryway. So
like a overpass kind of thing. Yeah, a little ridge. That's right. All the seats are black. What were they before that? Weren't they yellow? Weren't they gold seats?
No. I think they were black, weren't they?
Before they were renovated, too? I thought they were another color.
Oh, maybe red? I think they might have been red.
Maybe they were red. I was thinking gold because of the P Bruins, because I figured they've been playing there for a long time. Otherwise, obviously, we don't have any – don't need a history lesson. We've been here before. I just wanted to see when it was actually started being called the Dunk. Attendance, 8,000, which is not capacity.
No.
Two people of the 8,000 in that building are the two gentlemen who you are hearing at this moment.
Mm-hmm.
And sadly, as much as we don't thank him for a lot because he's, you know, the resident yard gnome, we have to thank Mr. Silverback himself.
That's right.
For these fine tickets that because midget. You got him his job. And
not really. That was the biggest fallacy of the whole thing. Was that? I mean, I was a bit. He got the job indirectly because I left and they needed to replace me. And I basically just told Dr. G, hey, you know, Matt's looking to move out here, and he'd be a good worker, and obviously he's still there 1,100 years later or however long it's been.
Yeah, some days I'd fuck both of you because of it. No. Because he, the person replacing you in encoding moved to that spot,
right.
So there was an opening on the A&E side in master control, and the yard gnome took that spot.
And wobbled in and stayed there. But he, so as a thank you, he got me two tickets, and I took you. I didn't take him. I mean, I don't think I was supposed to take him, right? I'm pretty sure that was...
Well, no, he was living there now. He was actually living...
Well, you were living there, too, and you came.
Well, he was probably working. That's probably... Because we visited him that day, remember?
Did we?
Yeah, because you were here because you came to Dr. G's Christmas party. And then you and I... Your wife took the separate car, and you and I took my car. But before we left, we went down and visited him. I think he was working. That's why he gave him to you. I don't think you were meant to go with him.
Right, okay. I didn't think so either.
So, no.
And that was our first live show since WrestleMania 20. So,
yes. It was just you and I.
Years. Yeah. Yeah, just you and I. Is that the only time I think just me and you went to a show alone?
I believe so. Yeah, I think so.
Not part of 75 people like we usually do now.
No, not at all. And it was just and it was for rarity. There wasn't like, you know, pregames and all sorts of. The pregame was tenders, pizza, and Rockers Orient Express. I do remember we came to your, we went to your house on Cornell. We completed the tree trimming. Mm-hmm. Your first tree. It was your first Christmas in that building, in your house. And we had some tenders and some pie, and then we drove out. And who'd we have standing in line in the freezing cold but your Cox cable guy?
Yes.
We all know one of your favorite companies.
Well, he had just been there, it was like a few days earlier he had come, because I was, of course, having problems. And he had come, and I was like, oh, hey. I was like, yeah, you were just at my house.
He was trying to fix the network for you, right? Because you'd only had the network for
was that
couple
the issue?
Months. Yeah, the network wasn't coming.
And he was asking for tips on how to work the network. Was that?
Yes. But anyway, we were standing
network,
in line.
24/7, obviously. You mean
24/7? Yeah, obviously, yes. 24/7. Obviously, it was very cold, obviously, being Christmas time, the week before Christmas, actually. And
we parked in the garage, right? Was that when we did the Orton pictures? Was that one?
Yes, we did the Orton pictures, and we walked under the overpass, and we were kind of marveling at the convention center because it was only a couple months old at that point. Mm-hmm. And but then there was a decent. We got there a little earlier than we probably wanted to because we didn't want to stand in the 11 degree temperatures, but we did. But I'm trying to remember. I mean, 8,000. Did they cover up the top? I mean,
they
know
had
that
a pretty big set too.
Yeah, it was so that big scaffold.
That whole back
half
was pretty much covered.
Yeah, so that probably that's true. Probably ate up a good 4,000 seats or whatever. Your buy rate 0.73, which actually is pretty good for a December pay per view. 0.73 is not bad at all. And your announcers at ringside, of course, the voices of the Blue Brand, Michael Cole and Taz.
We should mention too, it was around this time. I forget if it was already for No Mercy, but SmackDown's now on Fridays.
Yes,
that switch happened around here somewhere.
Yeah. Loaded with confidence. Give us the Sutton report.
Yes, it's been shaken. Okay, yes. Let's see here. So, do you remember the song? It's pretty much the standard Armageddon song.
Yes, the end.
Yes, the end.
The end is here.
But it's like the Jim Johnston version, not the.
Yes, not the Doors.
Sponsored by.
Do you remember that today? It was Microsoft.
Yes, Microsoft 360.
Xbox 360, yes.
Championship roll call. Batista still your world champion. U.S. title is vacant. Tag team champions, Batista and Rey Mysterio. We'll talk about that very soon.
Yes.
Cruiserweight champion, still Juventud Guerrero. We had a couple of releases in December. Mm-hmm. Do you remember? Actually, just one.
Who got released?
Actually, no, two. One December 5th, one December 8th. One was a female, one a male.
The female was...
Female had only been around a little over a year.
Gail Kim?
No.
No, she got released a while ago. Only a year. Not Christy, right? Was it Christy Hemme?
Christy Hemme was released due to budget cuts. One of her 47 matches for the promotion, she was 6-7-0. And of course, we talked about the rumors with her earlier in an earlier episode. The stuff with Triple H and whatnot, whether founded or unfounded, whatever it is. She was released, of course, due to budget cuts. And another stalwart was released December 8th. He had been around since 01 when WCW and ECW went under. He was one of the guys that jumped over.
Mm-hmm.
Remember?
Not RVD.
Nope. Pretty solid run off and on.
Raven?
Nope.
No.
Close.
No, because Raven was in TNA in 03.
Right, and he had been in WCW for a while.
Yeah, not Tommy.
You're on the path.
ECW guy.
Cruiserweight.
Not Nunzio, because we would see him on this evening. Mm-hmm. Not Super Crazy.
He was in the U.S. title picture on and off.
Mikey Whipwreck. Not Rene Dupree.
Friends of William Regal.
Shit.
On December 8th, Tajiri was given his release from the company so he could go back and work in Japan. Of his 610 matches, his TV record, 103, 135, and 4, no contest. 333 episodes of SmackDown, 181, Velocity, 78, Impact. Turning Point had a commentary and commentator and manager Bobby Heenan joined Mike Tenay and Don West to commentate on one of the matches. Hints of Sting coming in possibly happened at the end of the night as well when Jeff Jarrett retained his title over Rhino. Steel Cage Warfare, Lance Storm hinted he would come out of retirement to face Bryan Danielson on one of the Ring of Honor shows. Armageddon Heat, Jamie Noble defeated Funaki. And we'll talk about a couple of the facts here as we move along.
Okay. So, yeah, here we go. The final pay-per-view of 2005. And we begin with an unusual opener.
Not unusual.
Because of, I don't know, two guys you never thought would feud, and then the circumstances surrounding what would happen in the match. How do we get to this very strange opener?
Well, on December 16th, JBL butted his way into a Matt Hardy backstage interview. The two men brawled, and the match was set up. Later that night, Hardy was wrestling Booker T. When JBL left the announce table, dropped Hardy with the clothesline from hell. And here we be. So, great use, I thought, of JBL. He's still with Jillian. I like him in these mid-card feuds. Like, I thought, you know, it was nice to see him mixing up somewhere now outside of the... You know, it's been a while that he hasn't had the world title, so it's still... But it still feels kind of fresh that he's in feuds like this. Hardy continues to rebuild his identity. And JBL, though, kind of drugged that all up during the pre-match promo here. Just brings it all back up, all the stuff with Lita. Like, everything they've kind of buried, you know what I mean? Like, all came back to the surface. Called him a whiny bitch and a friend to the internet geeks and all that stuff. So Hardy, and when you look at it, it's actually a pretty natural feud. Like, JBL always rails against the internet kind of fans, and Matt Hardy was kind of their icon at this point.
Right.
So Hardy attacks from behind through the crowd. He hammers away. Hardy goes to work in the lower back, and then for him, things pretty much go south immediately. He gets hung in the ropes, hangman style. JBL just punishes his head with punches and kicks and yanks on his legs, and Hardy just looks completely out of it once he gets freed, and I love that attack. JBL has beat the piss out of him. Then he hits some stiff clotheslines on the floor. He keeps pounding with hard strikes, so we get some good selling by Matt. Matt hits a neck breaker, but JBL comes back with more attack on the throat and head. And I like the bullying offense of JBL here. It's very punishing. He really beat the piss out of him. Hardy comes back, or he blocks a back superplex. It's a moonsault for a near fall. JBL pulls off the turnbuckle, clotheslines Hardy into the corner, and then it's a clothesline from hell for the win. In many ways, this felt like a squash, but it was a well-worked squash. Like, I really enjoyed it. It built and really was more of a kind of a bad twist for Matt, and then led to the focused assault and some cheating. Like, and Cole and Taz were really focused on that throughout the match. Like, I like this because it was different. Not every match has to be back and forth equal, even when it features guys that are on the same plane. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. We can have matches that are one-sided sometimes because something goes wrong and it happens. And I thought they told that story well. They did it. So it seemed like a squash if you're watching without sound or whatever, but if you're paying attention to the story, it kind of made sense that Hardy gets tangled in the ropes, JBL beats the shit out of him, busts his head up, and he's just never the same. He can't recover, and JBL wins. So I like that. I like Cole and Taz here, and I thought it was a little bit of a hidden gem in some ways. Like, JBL's offense is really sharp. He beat the crap out of Hardy, and Hardy sold really well. You know, why don't you talk about the match, and then we can get into some of the circumstances that possibly led here. But I liked it. I was surprised at how much I enjoyed it as an opener.
It was an interesting booking decision. I mean, he obviously wasn't holding back on anything. He was not holding back on the kicks and punches. He was pretty stiff. He punished him. He punished him, tortured him almost. I mean, that kick he gave when he was guillotined in the ropes was pretty vicious. Which, again, as we're going to talk about, I wasn't sure where that was coming from. I thought it was very strange for a feud to just, like, be ignited 2 days before, and that was pretty much it. Obviously, they needed to fill a slot on the show, but as we're going to talk about, there may be more to this than meets the eye, but the match, as it stands, was a pretty effective squash. The only issue I have in terms of direction, if it's just a straight up match that didn't have any background involved in it. You have Matt Hardy who's you know, still kind of hot with the fans, and it could be led in a direction over JBL, who, even though, you know, he's still lower main event, upper mid card to this point, you really don't know what you're going to do with him. So the decision of who wins the match was a little strange, but if JBL's job was to systematically dissect, he did a pretty good job of it. I mean, he was hitting kicks and punches pretty... He was hitting Matt pretty hard. Matt was taking a pretty stiff beating.
Right, and I think it's, you know, I think it's fine that JBL would win because they're setting him up for some stuff coming up in 06. I think it's more the way he won, where Hardy basically got no offense. And again, on the surface, felt like a squash. But, you know, if you pay attention to the story and the way they built the match, it actually made a lot of sense. And, you know, it really felt like they were going... They really felt like for Hardy, they were going for the like never say die kind of attitude. Like even here, he just keeps coming, even though he's out of it. And it seems like that's what they've been doing with this character. And who knows? I mean, you know, do they really give a shit about him? I don't know. Are they saying just go do what you want to do? Are they doing this on purpose? I have no idea, honestly, at this point. You know, there were rumors at the time that he was punished for what he did at Survivor Series, where he dodged the Undertaker when he came back at the end and beat the shit out of everyone. He kind of just ducked out of the ring, and they were pissed at him for that. There were rumors as well. I don't know if it was something he had done online or said something about Lita. I didn't get all that, but I'm pretty sure it was the Taker thing that was right. A direct punishment. I can't find anything either way, but if I remember, right. Just from the time, it had to do with that.
Makes sense.
Because he really does come across like he's squashed. I mean, it's under 7 minutes, and he gets no offense in, pretty much.
No, he gets killed. And the whole punishing thing makes sense, because if you remember, he's not anywhere in the ring when Taker cleans everybody out at the end of Survivor Series. Really, I think it was meant for just Orton to duck out. And, you know, I think Matt was trying to kind of ride those coattails, and it cost him, because he got lathered. It's pretty safe. So there you go. JBL gets the win in the opener.
Just quick, what do you think of JBL, though, as a – I mean, obviously good in this role, but
right.
What do you think about him as a – you know, is he someone who should be putting guys over, or do you look at him as someone that should still be, you know, a guy that wins matches and contends for titles?
I think he could still contend for titles. Should he contend for the world title? That I don't know. But he definitely should still be in contention. He could be a U.S. champion, or, you know, they could find him a good tag team partner or something. I don't think he should be a guy who, depending what they thought his timeline was, I don't think he should be a guy to put guys over completely yet. I think he still had some usefulness, but in terms of world title, no, he pretty much got that done when he lost twice to, or when he lost to Batista at SummerSlam. Otherwise, I think he was definitely still useful, and I think that's what made this beating of Matt so much more effective. Is that here's a guy who's still pretty much a heel leader on the SmackDown roster. So that's why I think it was very effective. But I definitely think JBL still has some usefulness in the mid card. As a, you know, Intercontinental or U.S., depending on what show you're talking about. But I think that's why he was used in this situation, because he still has a little cred. Whether he's a main eventer, that I don't know. Probably not. I think that usefulness went out when he lost to Cena and then lost to Batista at SummerSlam. But he gets a win here. Like you said, match just a little under 7 minutes, and it's pretty much a one-sided, you know, dissection. Throughout the evening, to pump up the main event, they were doing something called Undertaker's Hell in a Cell Last Rites Moments.
Yes.
Because, you know, you need to have that many words. And the first one they showed was, of course, one of the most memorable ones, and that was the 1998 King of the Ring, where he chucks Chubby Mick off the cell and onto the...
Was it Mick or Owens? I want to cross, maybe. So we go backstage, pretty hot backstage segment here, where Melina comes on to Batista and basically says, you know, we'll get it on. I'll give you that as a payment. You give me you guys back off. Actually, was this on?
This was
SmackDown.
On SmackDown,
right? So it was a backstage certificate for SmackDown. So basically, she said, you know, I'll nail you, and then you and Ray not face Eminem for the tag titles later that night. So Batista says, okay. Well, he doesn't actually say okay. He just kind of swings around on his lap. He takes care of business, empties out. And then basically said, you know, he lied. So screw you. And then they end up having the match. And
yeah, screw you, like I did.
Batista and Ray end up winning the tag titles. And then backstage here, the Mexicools show up and they offer to back off if Melina will screw them. they'll cancel their match here tonight with Eminem.
And I think what makes this funny is that at least Batista's like a, you know, a good looking guy, and
right.
Psychosis and Super Crazy aren't exactly the best looking human beings on the planet, which made that even funnier. But I love the way Batista says it. He goes, "Oh, there'll be no deal, but thanks anyway." Oh, I feel great.
Yeah, it was good. It was a really good segment. And even, I mean, I remember just being there live and everyone cracking up when they do the thing where, you know, he spins her around and like smacks her ass when she's sitting on his lap.
I know.
the only problem here was it felt a little uncomfortable because of how tied to reality it was, because obviously at the time the whole thing was that they were actually hooking up and like Morrison knew and wasn't doing anything about it. Remember, I don't remember if that happened after this or during this time, but he ended up losing like a lot of Vince McMahon's respect for not, and the locker room's respect for not standing up to Batista and basically, you know,
letting his woman, you know, get some action. Yeah. I read that in Batista's book. Batista was very vague in his book.
Right.
He said like, I don't want to talk about Melina. She's one of my dearest friends, and we had, you know, we were good friends, and we were very close. So what you're saying? They're pretty much saying Batista is, I don't want to call her a whore.
When this was going on, or was that? I remember that whole
What's
thing.
What's that?
Did his wife have cancer too, or something?
Yes, or his girlfriend, or his, like the person he was actually living with. Yeah, she was sick, and he was sticking it to Melina. Yeah, but Batista was not overly flattering in his book during this time about, you know, the fact that he was sticking it to Melina while his girlfriend was sick or whatever. So
yeah, and Morrison is, I think he probably just watched half the time. But so anyway, that it's too bad that it went that way. I mean, it doesn't really hurt Melina's push, but I feel like she started really well, and we'll talk more about that here too.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, she looked good at Survivor Series, and I feel like she's really climbing the ladder. So, but it sucks to see any kind of like backstage stuff start to derail her a little bit, because her and Eminem been a really good act so far in 05.
Yes, yep, definitely. Speaking of Eminem, that's our next match. Tag team match here. Not a lot of title matches on this show, JR. Just one, and we'll get to that one later. Now, we talked about earlier in the show live that the Mexicools were like, hey, mamacita, but how did we get to this match?
On 12-2, Psychosis and Super Crazy won a tag team battle royal to earn a title match here. The next week, Crazy would defeat Mercury in a singles match. But unfortunately for the Mexicools, Eminem would lose the titles prior to the show, so this becomes a non-title affair, no pun intended.
Mm-hmm.
Are you shocked the Mexicools have lasted this long?
Yes. Yeah. But they caught on. They were they were a good gimmick. People dug them. I had no issues.
I don't know if I'd say they were a good gimmick. They were good workers. And
well, they were good workers, and it was a, you know, incredibly I guess you could say it was an incredibly racist gimmick, but
yeah.
You know, I definitely am surprised they were. I'm not surprised they're still there.
It's a Trump-esque gimmick. We're gonna make the Mexicools great again.
Yeah. Trump driving around in a wand deer, but a Trump deer.
No, it was very, it was not the most flattering gimmick, but they were really good in the ring, and they had good charisma, and they were pretty funny. So, yeah, they caught on. It is, you know, the BWO went away quickly, so it is, I was always surprised the Mexicools hung on this long, especially Hoovy, who we'll talk about in a few minutes.
Yeah.
you know, Crazy didn't completely surprise me because he was so awesome in ECW, and he had he was the one that probably connected the best with the crowd, but... So Eminem, their brief second reign came to an end. Remember, they had knocked off Heinrich and Animal to regain the belt, and now they lose them right back, kind of slipping down the card. Mexicals do not get much of a reaction here from us, very tepid. Mercury and Psychosis open up with a basic back and forth. Psychosis misses dives in the corner and lands hard on his head, but catches Mercury coming off the top. Mercury gets knocked to the floor. Psychosis dives onto both Eminem. Crazy follows with a somersault dive over the ref's back, bringing the crowd into the match. Eminem regained control and double team to maintain. Melina starts screaming in delight. The crowd rallies Mexicools, but Eminem uses heel work to keep on top. Eminem knocks Super Crazy to the floor to block a tag. Nitro gets a nice back suplex for near fall. We get some pretty good offense, and you know they built it well because the crowd is staying engaged now after being really flat to start. So he coasts to Enziguri for a couple of close after a couple of close calls, makes a hot tag after the match resets. Super Crazy out hustles both Eminem, gets the near fall on a tornado DDT on Mercury. Psychosis is a high cross body on both Eminem members. Nitro makes a desperate save on Super Crazy pin. And by this point, I thought the match got really hot. Super Crazy gets trapped. Eminem hits a snapshot for the win. And this is one that Eminem needed badly. Like, you know, that Mexicools could easily take a loss here. Eminem needed a win after, you know, what had happened in the weeks leading up to this. I thought this was a really fun tag match. They worked super hard and smart within a classic tag structure, and they won over a dead crowd, and the crowd was really rocking by the end. They cut the ring off in half nicely, Eminem did. We had good, well-timed comebacks, and you know, I feel like we're actually a very surprising 2-for-2 on this night so far, and I was happy to see that the crowd woke up and kind of got into this match after it started a little shaky.
Yeah, I think we knew that at least it was going to be entertaining. You had four good workers, but I agree with you 100% that it's been an odd few months for Eminem. They've kind of gone up and down when you thought, I mean, we had said a few pay-per-views ago that we thought they should have dominated the tag division, and really they didn't. They were doing a lot of win-loss, win-loss. They were kind of going 50-50, which was kind of surprising for them. But the in-ring was very good. Yeah, they definitely picked the pace up. They got slightly longer than the first match, about 8:56. So they had a decent enough time to tell a pretty good story, more than the Mexicals were used to. And I enjoyed it. That was great. But Eminem definitely needed the win, because it has been kind of an odd few months for them. And considering all the backstage nonsense going on, a win was necessary. Because honestly, they were the best team, the best tag team on SmackDown. And then without the titles, just makes them seem kind of empty. So a win today on this night on pay-per-view was definite and needed. So Eminem gets the win. It's a definite fun match, and yeah. I think it showcases that the Mexicals were a workable bunch of guys who...
Oh, they were great workers. And, you know, I mean, this is where they're suited for it, flying around.
Yep.
You know, pretty good selling and hitting a few high spots and working the crowd up into a frenzy at the end. Like, no, they were good. I mean, if you had given them... If you kind of stripped away the hokey lawnmower gimmick and just let them be luchadors, like, I think, you know, they could have really worked as an undercard team a little bit better than they did. As it is, they worked pretty well, but I don't think they'd be looked at as hokey as if they didn't have that part of their gimmick in place.
Exactly, exactly. And, again, they were just there to make an entertaining match. A win was not needed, but for Eminem, it was most definitely needed. Why do you think they weren't booked as the dominant team? Because really, they are the only real tag team in the you know, on the show.
Eminem.
Yeah, I mean on the show and the brand. You know, Heidenreich and everybody, all the other teams were like singles guys.
I think they were. I mean, the LOD thing was a nostalgia run that lasted a bit longer than expected, but they pretty much set up as the dominant team. I mean, the reason they lost here doesn't have to do with them not being booked that way. It's more, it's more to do with them wanting to do an angle with the other guys. Mm. Like, the guys they lost to me, doesn't mean, like, they're not being used well, I guess.
No, and I remember us talking about this back then when we were there in the building, and we'll get more into that when we get to that match later on, what I thought about the need for a title change. But anyway, Eminem kind of...
I saw them as, like, immediately... I think they got such a good push, and they were pretty over that they just saw them as a team that didn't necessarily need the titles, but you could get the titles back on them anytime you needed. That makes sense?
Yes. No, it does make sense.
So, like, hey, we could get the belts off them. They're still going to be looked at as a great team, and as soon as we want the belts back on them, they can win them, and it's credible.
Right. Okay. So Eminem gets the win and gets back on the winning track, and we'll see how things go the next couple of months if they can get back their WWE Tag Team Championships. Next up, probably one of the tri-main events. Indeed. One of the tri-main event matches here. The show's going to be very light on audio clips.
Yeah, not a lot going on.
After we went through a zillion clips in the last couple of Raw shows, Raunts and combo shows, or anything on this one. So this obviously feud continues on.
You know,
from...
It's funny, speaking of audio clips, I listened to my daughter has been really into having music on while we eat. Mm-hmm. And her station that we will put on is the Pandora Disney movie theme songs. And the Lion King one came out the other day, and it reminded me of Mabel, all the Mabel jokes. I can't wait to be king, the one that we used to always play for him.
Oh, yes, yes.
So, anyway.
And speaking of, another song that came up on the radio today was Candy Girl. So it was Mabel Day today. Candy Girl. All right. So this storyline goes all the way back to Jesus. Late October, early November, for the United States Championship. Where are we at this point, JR?
At this point, we are at match number four.
Four.
So the best of seven series between these two men continued on a special Tuesday night episode of SmackDown that aired on 11/29. Booker snuck out a win there to go up 2-0 after he'd won the first one at Survivor Series. Later that night, Benoit defeated William Regal and then assaulted Booker, who had been on commentary. He beat Booker down and locked him in the crossface on the floor. And then on 12-9, Booker went up 3-0 after he got an assist from Charmel and a steel chair. So Benoit in a 3-0 hole here in the best-of-seven series of the vacant U.S. title, looking to pick up his first win and not get swept. And, of course, Charmel has the broom. I thought that was a funny touch. Mm. Also backstage, Charmel cuts into Booker's interview with Crystal and clearly just running the show now. And she's been a real revelation to me watching these. I knew she was good. I didn't realize how quickly she became really good with the heel stuff. So must win for Benoit. Charmel pretty much running Booker's career, pushing the heel turn along. I thought this is the most inspired work Booker's had since, what, early 03 probably, when he was doing, you know, he had done Book Dust and then the stuff with early on with Triple H. And then since then, it's kind of been mired in this weird funk. And I thought he's finally snapped out of it with this shit, with Charmel and this feud. Benoit lands some early chops, sends Booker to the floor to regroup. Booker tries to wrestle Benoit, but Benoit reverses and grinds as the crowd cheers him on. Benoit goes for a crossface, but Booker slips to the floor. Benoit goes to work on the knee and the groin, and the crowd is just really hot for him here. Booker chops his way back into control, but Benoit hits a German to cut him off. Good analysis on commentary. I liked how they talked about Benoit needing to wrestle a perfect match to stay in the series and not get swept. Booker hooks on an abdominal stretch. Booker works out of some Germans, but Benoit hits a belly-to-belly, follows with the Three Amigos. Booker takes a real beating in this match. I thought Benoit just beats the piss out of him left and right with chops and strikes and the suplexes. Like, everything was stiff. Benoit floats over to block a superplex and takes a nasty fall out of the mat. Charmel runs some interference. Booker hits a scissor kick for a super close near fall. Booker gets to the ropes to block the crossface. The ref gets bumped. Benoit goes to the sharpshooter. Charmel comes in and hits him with the broom. Booker drills Benoit from behind while he's tied up with Charmel. And then Benoit blocks the bookend with the DDT and hooks the crossface for the tap out and the win. I love this match. I thought it was really good and hard fought. It was well structured. They beat the shit out of each other. You know, Booker took a great beating, and Benoit just outlasts Charmel this time because the whole story's been Charmel screwing him left and right, and now he's able to outwork her and outsmart her to get back into the series. You know, I liked this one better than the Survivor Series. I think it's kind of a hidden gem in many ways. They go 20 minutes. It's super stiff. The finish is hot. The crowd was into it. I like this match a lot. I really enjoyed it.
It could be a candidate for match of the year in 05, at least top five. I mean, they worked so hard. And the one best thing about these two, and we've, you know, we won't go and, you know, try not to repeat what I said at Survivor Series, but they find a way to make every match different. I mean, this is the fourth match, and you think that, you know, there's only so much you could do with the same guy, but most certainly not. Because every match in the series has a different hook, different psychology hook. In this instance, Benoit is desperate, and he's trying to, in essence, win the match without having Charmel kind of stick it to him again. And there were a couple times where you thought, well, I mean, you kind of knew going in Benoit was going to win. I mean, I couldn't honestly see Booker sweeping four straight. I just couldn't see that happening. The question is, what would they do? How would they go around it? Would it end in a schmoz or something? But it's good that Benoit finally found a way to circumvent Charmel's interference, and Booker tapped out to the crossface. I mean, that one moment outside where they are just chopping the shit out of each other, mm-hmm. So stiff.
I mean,
so
Benoit
stiff.
Really took a beating. Like, I kept coming back to it because I'm like, everything he does, Benoit would just whack him with another chop, whack him with another punch, kick him. Yep. Like, the suplexes. Like, Booker must have been sore as fuck after this match because,
yeah.
I mean, just took a real shit-kicking throughout this whole match.
Yeah, he did. He did. And Benoit wrestled, I think the psychology was perfect here because Benoit wrestled like a guy who was desperate, who needed a win in the absolute worst way, and just needed
to punish Booker because of it.
Exactly. And survived Charmel's interference. And speaking of Charmel, I'm going to back up your comments. There's no doubt that you didn't think she was going to be this good, you know?
No. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, she was Paisley and everything, but, you know, she didn't have to work as hard in that role. Here, she's got Booker wrapped around her finger, and that's what it needed to be. And she's already got the crown, like she's got the little tiara on and everything. So she's settled into this role perfectly as Booker's wife and kind of caretaker and almost in a very sensational Sherry type role, you know. And it's definitely helped him, it's definitely elevated him back to a good level in the company and on the roster. But yeah, he falls short here.
Reinvigorated him, and I don't know if it's because working with his wife or just being the heel again.
Yeah.
But her doing the whole shtick of controlling his career and basically telling him what to do all the time, like, yeah, that's... And it's built nicely. Like, I didn't realize the build, and we talked about the Survivor Series. I didn't realize all the build that went into it. Like,
right.
The fact that, you know, they, you know, Charmel was pissed because Booker wasn't having that killer instinct, and she slowly took more and more control. And remember, she bitched him out at No Mercy when he didn't have the killer to go after. You know, Benoit's not your friend, and he beat you. You know, like all that stuff. Like, it built and built and built to where it makes sense that Booker finally just gave in and let her take control. Like, it's, I thought it was really well booked. It was much better booked than I thought.
Yeah.
Or built, I should say.
Yeah. She definitely got her personality to step to the fore. And yeah, no, I was impressed. It was very, great job by Charmel. This feud has been fantastic. These matches have been fantastic. And this is the best one of the four so far. And so Benoit wins. He cuts into Booker's lead. Booker now leads 3-1. And I believe match 5 was that following week on SmackDown. We'll get more into it.
We'll talk about it again because it drags. Like, it was going well here, and then it starts to drag out a bit.
Yeah, it could have ended before it did. But the feud itself doesn't end for a few.
Things happen, and it gets sidetracked, and we'll talk about it all. But
yeah.
It goes off the rails a bit.
Right. So there you go. Chris Benoit gets the win, and... Booker now leads the series 3-1. Matches to one.
I know. It's hard not to say it.
I know. And
I love
you
the
know.
Broom, too. That was such a good
The broom is pretty awesome.
Nice touch.
Yeah, the broom is pretty awesome. I'm trying to think how their first series went. Did it go back and forth? Somebody must have gone up 3-1, I'm guessing. Or again, 3-1.
I think I'll try and look quick. I'm pretty sure Booker was 3-1 on that one, too. They ended up having an 8th match. I think they had a draw. Or is that this one? I don't know. I remember at some point they had... I thought they had a draw in there, and they ended up having an 8th match.
Maybe? Well, we'll get more into it because they do... I don't think we talk about it here again. Probably
right,
until No Way Out.
Match 1. Benoit beat Booker... match 2, Booker beat Benoit on Thunder. The first was Nitro. Match 3 on Saturday night, Benoit won, so it went up 2-1. Match 4, Benoit won again, so he was up 3-1 in that one on Nitro.
Okay.
Thunder, match 5, Booker won. Match 6, Booker won again on Nitro, and then at the Bash, Booker beat him in match 7. So there was no draw, and there's no draw this time either, so I must be thinking of something else.
Okay. Maybe it was... the Booker Cena? It's probably the only thing you think of.
No, I don't think... no, it wasn't there either. I don't know.
Hmm. Okay. So in any event, right now, Booker still leads the series 3-1, but Benoit gets some momentum back with a submission victory here in match number 4. And I don't think we talk about it again until No Way Out, because I don't think they do anything at the... Obviously, they're not New Year's Revolution. I don't think there's anything at the Rumble. So, all right. We have our second Taker Hell in a Cell Last Rites moment, and it's at Armageddon 2000, if you remember. Of course, that was the six-pack Hell in a Cell for the WWE Championship, and of course, that was when he chokeslammed Rikishi into the mulch.
Yes.
Because the one thing that you need is a mulch truck. We always had that weird discussion. So, anyway. So we go back to the ring.
Yes, the ring now, where Teddy Long and Palmer Cannon come out to talk about SmackDown's 2005 successes. Palmer brings out Santa Claus and an elf, and of course, this is the FBI. And I love the mashed up music they used here with the kind of the, you know, the FBI was already using a No Sleep Till Brooklyn knockoff, and then they meshed that up with those like jingling bells, or was it Jingle Bells, or what song do they have? They had some song in there. Mixed in with the FBI theme.
I think it was Jingle Bells, yeah.
Yeah, so that was kind of cool. So they make fun of the crowd. They ask for various title shots for 2006, or for Christmas, rather, to come in 2006. And then Palmer gives them a gift, and it's the Boogeyman. Boogie completely kills the flow of the show here. A weird character, just super into his gimmick. He gets a good reaction. Santa, who's Vito, pisses himself, and then Boogie wipes them both out, turns the gifts into worms, and then shoves the worms into Vito's mouth, which is really nasty. The crowd is actually into it, but it went really long and slowed up the show. And then we get a long Taker Orton video package, which I thought was good, but long. And then we get an Orton's interview. So we go like almost, it felt like a half hour in here of no action after those first couple matches, or first few matches,
right?
With all this stuff. And it, to me, the show had been flowing really nicely. Mm-hmm. I thought all three, the first three matches were good. And then, you know, the last one was really good. And then we go into this and it just, you know, dragged out. Like, do we really need Teddy and Palmer to talk? And then the FBI to talk, and then the boogeyman to come out. You know what I mean? Like, they kind of shrunk that down a little bit and not done as much BS or talking in there. I think it would have been a little bit better, a little bit tighter that way. So I don't know, that bugged me a bit.
Yeah, no, it did. We had a good groove going, and then it got a little, you know, this stretch here got a little slow. And what did you think of the boogeyman gimmick early on? This is obviously the second time we've seen it on pay-per-view.
Yeah.
Was it needed?
Yeah, I mean, it's fine. And then they're not taking it seriously yet, you know what I mean? He comes out, beats someone up, and throws worms in the mouth. Like, I think it's fine for what it is. Mm-hmm. You know, if it was starting to get into, like, title pictures or actually have legitimate feuds and matches, I'd say probably, okay, we're going in the wrong direction. But for, like, stuff like this, comedy fodder, like, I think it's fine. And he gets a good reaction because he's all creepy and does weird shit. So, like, there's that gross out factor. So, and he's into it. He's, you know, he's fully committed to it. So, I'm okay with it from that perspective. But I don't need to see, like, long segments of it or drawn out stuff. It's fine just in little snippets here and there.
Okay. Yeah, I thought it was fine, too. Guy was in good shape. And he obviously could do some moves. He's pretty cool pump handle slam. So, he obviously kind of knew what he was doing in the ring. So. I don't know if we had seen him in an actual match at this point yet, but all right. Next up, nothing more than a pure character enhancer. How do we get to this point on this match?
We all love Bobby. So Bobby Lashley had defeated William Regal on the 12-9 SmackDown, and the next week he defeated the man known as Paul Burchill as well. That led to the handicap match here, because if you can't beat one or the other, you know. Team up and try and beat them together.
That's right.
Paul Burchill started to train to become a wrestler in 2001, made his pro debut in 2002 for Frontier Wrestling Alliance in Great Britain. In 2004, it was announced he had signed a WWE contract after a brief stay in OVW. He was quickly called up to the main roster and made his debut on 827 Velocity, helping William Regal defeat Scotty Too Hotty. He would debut on SmackDown the next week, teaming with Regal to defeat Scotty and Funaki, and continue to work alongside Regal as the year wound down. And Burchill, do we see him again on pay-per-view? We don't have it here that he's done, but I don't remember.
I feel like he was on One More Time.
Is he like in a Rumble or something, maybe?
Maybe. Maybe he's in No Way Out. I feel like he was on One More Time.
I don't know.
It may not be immediate.
He may not be.
Mm.
Anyway, he's around for a while. He doesn't leave till like 08-ish. And he does the pirate gimmick, obviously. He does the incest thing way later on towards the end of his run, if you remember.
Oh, God.
Yeah. You know, we'd be in OVW a lot. So I don't see anything here that says for sure he was on another pay-per-view. He goes up and down a bit. But anyway, he... actually, let me see here. Yeah, no, I don't think... Yeah, I don't think he's on another pay-per-view.
Okay. I thought he was on at least One More Time somewhere down the line, but.
Yeah, he's not at the Rumble. A lot of SmackDown.
Well.
Yeah, anyway. So we may not see him again, but he does a lot of interesting, weird stuff.
Yes, he does.
The whole Pirates of the Caribbean thing. If you remember, Vince was not aware of the films or the character. I believe the character should have thought he was a real pirate. Begin once they brought it up, so he wanted him more like being like Jean-Pierre Lafitte versus like kind of being over the top, you know what I mean? Like Johnny Depp was, so that kind of went nowhere. He did that for a while, and then he did the whole stuff with his sister Katie Lee Burchill, where they did the basically hinted at the incest stuff, and then released in 2010. Actually, he'd be on ECW for a while.
So we don't see him on pay-per-view again, but he's with the company for five more years.
I mean, he may pop up somewhere, but...
I felt he was on One More Time, but well, I'm sure we'll run into it. We're going to run into it at some point, right, if it is. So, as for the match, well, I don't know if you did. You, I mean, it's
no,
it's
we didn't talk about the match yet. So,
oh, okay, good.
This is a good spot for Regal, kind of mentoring a young protege. Like, I like that. Lashley's still rolling and dominating, and most are both guys to start. A double team catches him, and Burchill drills the lower back to knock him to the floor. Regal runs Lashley to the post. The Brits start to beat on the back and wear Lashley down. Burchill hits a nice running diving knee to the back off the middle rope. Burchill gets some aggressive offense in, but then Lashley just chucks Regal across the ring, and Regal tags out, pushing the story of the match. Lashley throws Burchill around as well, hits a big power slam on Regal, and then finishes with a dominator on Burchill. Yeah, the match was fine. Again, pretty much another squash, a good showing for Lashley, picking up another win. I liked the Brits as a team. Like, I thought Burchill and Regal looked good together. I thought it made sense. You had the crafty veteran and the young guy. I was fine with using them here as long as, you know, you look at them as a potential team going forward, and sadly, I don't think they get much run after this. But, you know, it's fine. They pretty much just feed him to Lashley because they're trying to keep that train rolling.
Right. And he's I was liking Lashley a lot. I thought he was a good, solid, young power guy. And it didn't hurt for the company to have one. So I was fine with this. This worked out good. And Regal, you know, did the job he was supposed to do.
You think they, I don't know. What do you think Regal at this point? Like, should he have been doing more?
Probably.
Or I mean, has it kind of passed?
That's a tough question. I mean, there's obviously a lot of guys on this roster that could use his guidance, but at the same time, I mean, it's Regal, man. I mean, you could put him in anything and the fans will dig him. So I guess it really depends on your point of view or what your, what the, roster status is. You know, is this a guy who can really help train and teach, or is this a guy that you, I mean, you could do both at the same time, I suppose, but, is this a guy that you would really want to do a lot with in terms of pushing him into mid-card feuds, maybe even in a world title feud. You don't even know. You don't know. So I guess it depends on the situation at that moment. Right now, they must have thought Burchill was a decent talent that needed his help.
Even before Burchill, I guess I'm saying, you know, through most of 05.
Well, we've talked about how the roster has issues, so there's no doubt that you could have put Regal in something a little more, you know, a little more teeth. Because, you know, the roster was kind of thin at times with a lot of moving around and releases and
such.
Well,
it seems like we'll go like months without seeing him, you know?
I know. And he's a great hand. I agree with you 100%. Yeah, yeah. I agree with you 100%. We'll see him on and off.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, he gets back into some big stuff, and then he's one of those guys that anytime he gets rolling, something just derails him completely, and then he's going to start again. Like, that's pretty much his career at this point. But, yeah, I like the team with Burchill. I thought it had some potential. I thought Burchill looked good here too. I was actually kind of surprised they had him take the loss, and not just feeding Regal to Lashley instead. But, yeah, I mean they were hard up for tag teams on SmackDown too, so this could have been one that did more, but they just don't really click.
Yeah, no, not at all. And I'm sure Regal will be very, very valuable to the roster. You know, throughout 2006, because we're going to have some other issues with SmackDown that we'll talk about when we get into the new year. So, well, after this, so Bobby Lashley wins the handicap match. He gets barely 4 minutes, but he is the obviously shining star, the young shining stud coming up the ranks on SmackDown in the blue brand. Of course, as with any Providence show, JR, where do we end up like we do every year, which you and I still have yet to find, although I think it's closed now, but you know where we head? A friendly tap.
Yeah, not so friendly this time around, though. Not as friendly as normal. So
now for those, and I think we mention this every year, it's not officially in Providence, right? Isn't it in like Cumberland?
Yes, Woonsocket.
Yeah. Woonsocket.
So... so, all right. So we go to the friendly tap, and things start well. Like, it made sense. We talk about the dangers of Hell in a Cell because Tim White's career ended at Hell in a Cell due to shoulder injury. So why not send Josh Matthews here? Tim White works at the friendly tap. Let's talk about the dangers of Hell in a Cell. We'll put it over the gimmick. Makes perfect sense to me. Then things get dark. So White is solemn and depressed as he's drinking shots. Josh asks him how his shoulder is, but White won't talk. They show footage of White's career-ending injury, talk about all his pain. White says his wife left him, his family ignores him, his friends are gone, he's got nothing left. He's got all sorts of medical problems, including friggin' IBS, irritable bowel syndrome. Says he has nothing left to live for, and really depressing for Christmas. Look at like the Christmas bells in the background. And then White tells Josh to leave, and Josh wishes him a white Christmas. And then White pulls out a shotgun. Josh backs off and then kills himself off screen as Josh just stands there and pleads with him. Fucked up. Completely pointless. Completely kills the vibe of the show in the arena. Like, people were booing and just like, what is going on? And it was like a happy kind of environment for a while. Everyone had been into the matches and, you know, we were feeling good. And then this is just like, what the hell? We just watched a guy kill himself on pay-per-view. And it didn't end there. They would end up doing these ongoing skits on WWE.com where White would keep trying to kill himself, but and Josh would be there, and he kept failing. Remember, he like, put his head in a fan or whatever. It was like all this weird shit. It became an ongoing series. But it was really weird and just so unnecessary. Again, just like the earlier segment, filling up this show with trash when the card itself has actually been pretty good. And it's stuff like this that just slows it down and just drags it to a halt.
Yeah, there was no need. You little jerk. Yeah, there was no need for it. I understand they were trying to kind of do a gimmick and, you know, gave Josh Matthews something to do, but it was really depressing. And it did kind of kill the buzz of the show. I don't think there's any doubt about that. It definitely killed the buzz for the show. So, poor...
Yeah,
just,
you know, it's... I don't know. It's once you go there, I mean, where are you going, you know? Like, it's just...
Mr. White, please, Mr. White. Please, Mr. White.
It just made no sense. It was just wasn't funny at all. Like, just have him be depressed and angry that it ended his career. If that's fine, if you want to do that. And just put over the dangers. Like, we didn't need anything more.
He was going to kick a fan in the tub or something.
Yeah. It wasn't even funny. You know what I mean? Like, at least, again, just going back to, like, the Vince stuff. There's no point to it. You know, the Vince stuff is Survivor Series that we talked about. Like, if you're going to go there, if you're going to say the N-word on pay-per-view, if you're going to have suicide played for comedy on pay-per-view, at least, like, make it funny, you know? Make the impact. Make it count. Instead, it's just depressing and weird. And, like, Josh's white Christmas line was, like, cringeworthy.
Yes.
I know it was meant to be that way, but I don't know.
Now, if Josh Richer said it,
yes.
Well, then it would be.
Oh, he would have mumbled it and screwed it up somehow.
he would have said it very differently. No, Tim White, don't bite the burger.
I didn't like this thing at all. I thought it was really, I just thought it was really poorly done.
Right. No, it was kind of sad, and it did, you know, because I don't know if they thought that they were treating this like a throwaway show, but I've been fairly entertained so far, and all this.
It's almost like they didn't have faith in the card, but it actually delivered so far. You know what I mean? And you're telling me they couldn't find one more, pulled out two more guys from somewhere and had one more match to fill this time? Or let JBL and Hardy go longer. They only went 5 minutes. They could have went longer, you know?
Most definitely.
And even the tag match later could have went a little bit longer. So it's like they really – it's like they felt they needed to pad the show out, but I'm sure they could have found other ways to do it versus what they did. I mean, fuck, have a showcase Raw match if you have to. You know what I mean? Like, do that instead of this.
No, Mr. White, don't bite the burger.
He's dead.
Ay. All right. Why don't we take a break? Well, we continue our random RSVisms. And when we come back, 3 matches left. Only one of them for the title and not the one you think. We have a lot of belts in one match, none of them on the line, and then, of course, our feud capper in the main event. But first, plenty of words from the friendly tap, or in this case, unfriendly tap. Who bit the burger?
It's more depressing than Patty's Pub.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com. The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and PlaceToBeNation.com. You can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Main Event, Mission Indie Possible, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. And relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series, led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. We got sports covered too with the Sports Evolution Mega Show with Scott, Dr. G, Cowboy, and Cowboy Sr., the Kings of Sport led by Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, as well as the NBA Team Podcast and the TJ McClune Show. PTBN tackles pop culture and irreverence with Richard and the Mailman, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, and if you like a hybrid of all of this in list form, check out Jordan Duncan's Rank and File. All of these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. We want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation Podcast Network. That's the PWO PTBN Podcast Network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the reaction shows with good old Will from Texas. We got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO PTBN Podcast Network.
See, now if they played this, it would have been at least a little funny. You know what I mean? A little camp behind it. Instead of depressing. This might be the oldest song. This is the oldest song we've played on the show. This is like, I kind of picture this playing like, Scott Criscolo was born 1953. Like, this is your life segment on Scott Criscolo. All the black and white stills of you, like, doing different things as a kid with this playing in the background. Here's Scott Criscolo standing by as Rosa Parks moved to the front of the bus.
Rosa Parks!
Oh, God. On the back of the bus.
Here I am.
Did she go to the back or the front? I forgot how it worked.
She went to the front. Yeah. They want her to go to the back.
Scott Criscolo was there for George Mikan's first 25-point game.
George Mikan! There he is, standing in front of the first Dell's truck ever. There he is actually talking to St. Mary at the feast. Yes.
As he dodged the draft for the war in Korea, Scott Criscolo went to...
Dodge the draft! Oh, God. Okay. There he is with his 15 aunts and uncles.
And especially with the fucking the buzz cut and the glass. Remember when they did the 90210 where like Brandon was like the draft guy or whatever? Remember?
Yes.
Oh, the fucking warmonger and...
That's right.
Brenda was a hippie.
Yes, I do. Oh, that's a great episode.
Was that Vietnam? That was Vietnam, right?
Yeah, it was Vietnam, yeah.
But he had like the 50s look, right? Didn't he have like
yes.
The...
Yeah.
So I just picture you in like the white short sleeve button down with the black tie and the glasses and the crew cut.
Like Buddy Holly. Thank you.
Oh, man. All right, PlaceToBeNation.com is with you always. You won't want to dodge that, I'll tell you that much. No. Brian Bayless had his Raw rundown today. Stephen Ferrari's series, the WrestleMania Top 10, he's up through WrestleMania 8. Each of these going up one per day, where he's...
a lot of fun.
Watching every WrestleMania and ranking the matches, his top 10 matches every time. He's got some other fun list stuff in there as well from what he's watching, and he keeps updating the list after every Mania, cycling matches in and out of his top 10. And it actually ties into a larger project that we got going on that's coming the week of WrestleMania. I'm not going to give it away now, but it's a giant undertaking with many members of the PTBN staff, so that'll be coming the week of WrestleMania. Stay tuned for that.
Yes.
Big episode of the Kevin Kelly Show last night, Scott. Episode 53. We had two guests on. And Pete Gass of the Mean Street Posse joined us to talk about Shane McMahon's return. Possibility of the Mean Street Posse working Mania, maybe. Also, he told a couple of funny stories growing up as friends in the McMahon family. There's one in there you have to listen to where he talks about him and Shane and their friends riding motorcycles and Vince power walking down the driveway to yell at them. It was a pretty good story. So be sure to check that out. It was a great interview with Pete. He seems to be in a really good place in his life. He's kind of loving this resurgence in popularity. So he's embracing it with everything that he has. Cheeseburger, ROH kind of underground icon that's really gaining steam. Mm-hmm. He's actually become very popular, sold out T-shirts, and wrestled it over in Japan, and he's on a big six-man this weekend with the Briscoes. So check that out. Pete Gass and Cheeseburger joined Kevin on this week's Kevin Kelly Show. New episode of Between the Sheets.
Sounds like a sitcom. Coming up at 8:30, it's Pete Gass and Cheeseburger.
There you go. They should do a sitcom. That'd be awesome sitcom, those two guys. Between the Sheets, number 33, March 1st of the 7th, 1986, with Bo James joining Chris and Bix to talk about that week that was in the dirt sheets. Seinfeld rewatch series continued as we're very close to the end of season 6 with the face painter. We only have one more episode, so season 6 will be done this week, and then we'll move into season 7, believe it or not. All Japan Excess series is back. Stephen and Parv, episode number 15 of that series. Looking at some of the best from All Japan. New Glenn Butler Podcast Hour, episode 11. Looking at Star Trek 3, was joined by his brother Scott and Tim Capel as well. So be sure to check that one out. Scott, our Vintage World Refresh series continued with the main event from 2389. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Brad Woodling's Ring of Honor TV recap. Be sure to check that out as well. Dave Musgrave continued his series looking at Dave Meltzer's history of five-star matches. He's in part two, going through every Meltzer five-star rated match and giving his own critique of all of them. And I will point you to the newest XL and Bad Street as well, looking at the story of Continental Wrestling, part one, and that had Bo James as well. Tomorrow, Scott, on Wednesday, we'll continue our network adventure. We're up to Starrcade 83, so that should be live on Wednesday.
Yeah.
Be sure to check that out. I'll also have a new Thoughts, I Think column up this week as well, looking at the situation heading into Roadblock, where we're at with Roman Reigns and Dean Ambrose. I was talking about Chris Jericho, his elite kind of run that he's on right now this year, kind of overlooked by many, but he's been fantastic, as has AJ Styles. I talked about Sami Zayn. So a lot of news and notes in the new Thoughts, I Think column that'll be up this week as well. So placemanation.com, check it all out. Facebook.com/placetobenation, Twitter, place number 2BNation. Follow us on Instagram, on Tumblr, and everything else out there. So check on us more than once a day, because we have stuff rolling in all times of the day. You know, subscribe to our podcast feed. You can look at the Place to Be podcast. You can search out PWO-PTBN. You can get all our shows, and of course the Kevin Kelly Show as well. So subscribe to all three of those feeds. You'll never miss a show. And there are tons of great ones if you're into wrestling history, if you're into current wrestling, if you're into, you know, theater of the inane. There's a lot of that as well. So be sure to check all that out here at placetobenation.com.
Yes, you're home for everything in pop culture. Can you believe that you've gotten through six seasons of this without any issues?
No, I know. It's crazy.
Anything with Jordan Duncan, you kind of have to take with a grain of salt anyway.
All right. It's more surprising to me that, you know, Andy Flanagan's.
I knew you were going to say.
Completed six seasons. When he's not travailing through the mountains of Arizona.
Is he looking for superstar Billy Graham's house?
Fucking bow-legged piece of shit. Anyway.
All right.
The Senate election in 1954, Scott Griscolo went to the ballot box for independent Wayne L. Morse, who caucused with the Democrats, holding a 49-47 majority.
Oh, God. And he definitely likes Ike, as you can see in this picture.
Yes.
All right. Let's move on. Let's head back to the dunk. By the way, speaking of... quickly, before we continue on, speaking of politicians and provenance, rest in peace, one of my favorite people from your beloved state. I don't know what you thought of him, but what was it, about a month ago, I guess? No, it was less than that, maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, the passing of...
I was long ago, more than that.
Was it more than a month?
Yeah.
Really? Was it that far back? Wow. Of course, talking about former Providence mayor, Buddy Cianci, who had passed away. He was in his late 70s, I think. Met him a couple times. He was a funny guy. So let us go back to the dunk.
On March 11th, 1953, Scott Criscolo went to check out the debut of Richard III, adapted from Shakespeare's play, starring Laurence Olivier. I'm sorry, 1956, actually.
56, yes.
Andrea Doria, do you remember that?
Is that the, was that the cruise ship? Yes, yes, I do remember the, well, I don't remember it. Yes, exactly.
You
like that? I walked out of that one.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
right.
Just like the 262 miners that died in a fire in a coal mine in Belgium walked into the mine earlier that week.
Walked into a mine.
After going bankrupt in 1955, American broadcaster the Dumont Television Network aired its final broadcast, an episode of Scott, remind me, the boxing from St. Nicholas Arena. Now, where was St. Nicholas Arena? Were you, did you ever attend a live show there?
St. Nicholas Arena was probably somewhere in suburban Chicago or Milwaukee, because DuPont was a, pretty sure DuPont was like a Midwest. I mean,
New York
Dumont.
City, actually.
Oh, okay.
Aired on Monday nights.
That's right, and then I used to go to Toots. I guess I used to go to Toots with Toots. Yes.
Do you remember Elvis appearing on the Ed Sullivan Show?
I do.
1956?
Yes, I do. The, had a few old fashions with him.
Actually, later they aired Don Larson through the only World Series perfect game.
That's right. And then I would have some peanut butter gravy and two-and-all sandwiches with Elvis there.
Suez Crisis. A lot going on in 1956. Busy year.
Just listen to Billy Joel's song. It's all in there for you.
Okay, we're done.
Okay. All right. Back to the dunk for Armageddon 2005 and our only actual title match of the evening, JR. Could you believe this?
No.
An entertaining pay-per-view and only one title match. Your Cruiserweight Championship is on the line. Your champion
Speaking
is
of cruises, the Andrea Doria.
the Titanic 2. No. Your champion, as you mentioned earlier, the Sutton Report. The confidence you had mm-hmm. in one Hoovy. And this is a very highly anticipated match, but tell us what it is and how we got here.
On the 12-9 SmackDown, Kid Cash came out of the crowd and assaulted Juventud Guerrera.
What?
The next week, you defeat Super Crazy in a singles match. It was announced that he would challenge Hoovy for the title of the pay-per-view. And, of course, David Cash had began his mainstream wrestling career in 1996, working under the name David Jericho in ECW. He would leave ECW and work the indie scene as well as some Dirty F live events. It was during one of those events that Cash broke his ankles during a match with Too Cool. After healing, he returned to ECW under a new moniker, Kid Cash. Cash had a solid run, including wrestling through the healing of a broken jaw, as well as winning the ECW tag team television title. He would leave ECW in early 2001, head south to WCW, signed a contract on March 21st, but of course WCW was sold a week later. Upon that transaction, Cash decided not to accept a renegotiated contract from the WWF. He would instead surface up in TNA, where he would compete throughout early 2005. After making derogatory remarks in public about how TNA was using him, he was released from his contract. After making a brief appearance in One Night Stand, Cash would make his WTV debut in a tryout match on the 619 Heat, wrestling Tajiri. Later signed a developmental deal, quickly ascended to the main roster, beginning with Velocity matches. So...
I was kind of pumped. It was a guy I never thought we'd see in the company. It's cool to see him. He had a good reputation preceding him.
Really? You never thought we'd see Kid Cash?
I don't know. I mean, it depended how much they took seriously the Cruiser division. If they wanted to have those guys in, but, you know. Remember, indie guys at that point were still not really on WWE's radar, not at least for another year, probably. So...
This would mark the David Cash. This would mark the final pay-per-view appearance for Juventud Guerrera. Stuck around to the new year when on the 1-6 SmackDown he faced Cash in a rematch for the title. He used many high-flying moves. Despite Dirty asking his cruiserweights to tone down the style, he performed the 450 splash, a big no-no at the time, after Hoovy had botched the move on Paul London earlier in the year, yes. Resulting in severe fractured bones in London's face. That same day, Dirty announced that Hoovy was released from the company. Since then, he wrestled for some Mexican promotions, several stints in AAA, a few appearances at Dragon Gate, and on. Final record was 2-1 for the Juice. So released a little bit unceremoniously, but not as bad as, he had been from WCW when he tripped on acid and just tore up the hotel room in Australia.
Yes. Yeah, this was actually for at least a work reason. But
right.
Obviously, Hoovy was the jewel of the Mexicals. and that's why they made him the Cruiserweight champion.
Yeah.
But bummer with what would happen.
At least he has this little run here, but I mean, yeah. Like I said, it was only a matter of time before one of these guys. I mean, it was most likely going to be him, just because he was known as being kind of crazy, obviously, from what happened.
Yeah. Risk taker, yes.
Yeah, the juice.
The juice.
He definitely lasted longer than I thought. I'll say that.
Yeah, me too. Me too. And I didn't think any of them would win any belts. So I was kind of surprised that they had him as cruiserweight, that he would eventually win the cruiserweight.
And the division was kind of refreshed. Like, I thought they shook things up nicely. Two guys that haven't been around really much and fighting for the title is very different.
Yeah.
Of course, Cash was a solid pickup, like we mentioned, to bolster the division. Hoovy attacks off the bell. Cole pushes the revenge story. Hoovy's fired up. He hammers away. Hoovy goes to the arm and then dumps Cash to the floor and follows with a crossbody. Cash runs Hoovy into the post, and the crowd is flattened out, I think still dead from all the Tim White shenanigans. Cash targets the shoulder and the arm with a focused attack. Hoovy punches his way back in and dodges a moonsault, but Cash slams him down. Hoovy gets knees up on a nice top rope moonsault. Hoovy cracks Cash with a stiff kick for a near fall. Hoovy hits a top rope hurricanrana, but hurts his knee on the landing and can't cover immediately. Hoovy hits a driver after a series of reversals, but Cash kicks out. Crowd starts to wake up a bit. Cash comes back, avoids a somersault senton, and hits a dead-level brainbuster for the win. I like this match. The heat and intensity were lacking from the crowd, but I thought it was really well worked. I thought the finish was a bit of an upset, but I thought Cash was a good, strong worker to have on top. You know, if Hoovy had stuck around, I thought he could have been fun chasing after Cash in the title.
Mm-hmm.
Been kind of cool, but we don't obviously get there. But no, I thought he was a good choice. What did you think of Cash taking the belt?
I was surprised, but pleased. Burn, burn, burn the cruiserweight title. Burn, burn, burn.
Burn, burn, burn. Burn, burn, burn. Crack cocaine.
Ripping up the hotel. Paul London's funny smiley face.
Tripping on a bowl of acid.
I wasn't surprised. I remember you and I were sitting there going, you know, talking like, wow, this is, you know, it's a good moment for Cash, and I think he was a guy that could stabilize the division. But it would have been good. I wish they had lasted a little longer, and I wish that him and Hoovy had multiple matches. But you know, we don't follow the rules. You get the pink slip. So, having said that, good match. You know, 9:26, good length.
And again, it's another one that kind of surprised. It's like, all right, this card's been kind of solid, especially for you know, we're on a run of shaky December shows, especially coming off 04.
Oh.
And like you said, for a show that didn't have any really big hype title matches, you know, it's been fine so far.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's been and the crowd is, you know, except for some spots, I thought we were pretty good.
They were dead here. And again, I don't blame the match. It's just, you know, if you lop off the bullshit from this card, it's a real tight show. Like if you dump the Boogeyman stuff and you dump the Tim White stuff.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that because, and I agree with you because you've said it yourself, and one of your big examples is when you were live at that Raw when right before WrestleMania 17 when Austin and Rock had that long, you know, that long off-air segment.
Yeah, I think it was SmackDown, though.
Yeah, SmackDown, I mean. Those long Titantron segments will kill a crowd.
But at least that one, they were, you know, pushing a storyline. We saw a guy kill himself, you know. It was like,
yeah,
it wasn't even like a hot end. I mean, yes, that killed that show, but I mean, I can defend it, you know what I mean?
Right.
This you can't defend. It made no sense, like zero sense.
Yeah. I mean, I remember being at a Raw earlier this year in 2005 at Mohegan Sun, and it was the Raw with that Shawn Michaels, Larry King segment. And I understand that advanced the storyline as well, but that also kind of sucked the life out of the crowd too.
Right, but at least there's a purpose.
Oh, I understand. It's just still, though, regardless whether it's a purpose or not, it is very difficult to have those long Titantron segments. So,
especially on the end in suicide.
Well, yeah, in fake blood, you know, ketchup being spurted off camera, you know, it's kind of nonsensical.
Shot Josh instead.
Or, you know, they could have just... Love is a burning thing. Josh Matthews with a clown wig. So, Kid Cash,
and he
threw
that potted plant
out
the window.
So there you go.
The 19th floor.
Into the swimming pool. So there you go. Kid Cash is your new.
Could do that for all these transactions. And William Regal, Regal, pissed on that stewardess.
And Razor Ramon took a dump on Sonny's plate. No.
And then Ken Patera threw the brick through the window of that McDonald's. While Mr. Saito ate all the french fries. Was it Saito? It was him, right? Was it him?
Yeah, it was Mr. Saito. Jimmy Snuka then killed his girlfriend.
And got away with it. Well, Vince McMahon lied. And Hulk Hogan claimed his character as a 10-inch penis, but in real life has a 5-inch dick.
And it makes a fiery ring.
His 10-inch dick made a big fiery ring.
Did you see that, though? He said, he's on a road, and he said he's sticking to the fucking story about not knowing that he was going to beat Andre as he was going to the ring at WrestleMania 3, so people were saying they should try him for perjury for fucking lying.
Oh, Jesus.
Of all stories to stick to. I mean, unless he's going full Costanza, it is like, it's not a lie if you believe it. You know what I mean? Like, he's not lying because he honestly believes that at this point that he didn't know going to the ring. I mean, I don't know what the hell's going on.
Maybe me and Vin should have snorted all that coke. With Billy Jack Haynes and the 12-year
security guard's foot.
12-year-old prostitutes. All right. So Kid Cash is your new...
Sonny Sitch made a sad porno.
She's so confident in herself, she left her clothes on. So there you go, Kid Cash.
She clearly shattered confidence there.
Yes. Yes.
I'm just going to wear this giant t-shirt while you're banging me. Is that okay?
Yes. Yes. Oh, I have my own chubby computer virus. All right. Kid Cash is your new...
I'm just
going to
wear this Godwin's t-shirt while you nail me from behind. Is that okay? They should just went all in and just like have like someone throw the fucking slop bucket on her, like really just play it up, like just go full like 96 storylines in the movie. Have Hillbilly Jim like fucking in the background.
I'm just doing a hog pen. Why not? You know, never, you know.
Mind if I wear this smoking guns cowboy hat? Well,
yes. Well, I have this bag of pork rinds on me.
Yes.
Oh God! All right. Kid Cash wins.
Can you cut your hair short and dye it blonde like Zip?
At this point, Dr. Tom's probably in better shape.
Dr. Tom, we're going to get him on just to talk about that video.
Oh, God. Poor bastard. All right. Kid Cash, your new Cruiserweight kid. Josh Richard ruined his Duke jersey. Okay. All right. Next up, another part of the triple main event. This has a myriad of gold in it. None of it on the line.
No, I know, right? Dripping with gold.
Dripping with gold, and is the final vestige of the Raw versus SmackDown. It is. Crosses over from the red brand to the blue brand. How do we get here?
On 12-2, Big Show and Kane were invited to SmackDown for an interpromotional battle with JBL and Rey Mysterio. JBL walked out mid-match, allowing the Raw team to smash Mysterio, win the match. Show and Kane looked to inflict more damage to Mysterio after the bout, but Batista made the save and cracked both men with a chair to drive them from the ring. On 12-16, it was announced that Batista and Rey would challenge Eminem for the tag team titles prior to the match. As we mentioned, Melina seduced Batista to get him to back out. Being the beast that he is, Batista banged her and then thanked her for the warm-up, claiming he never agreed to any deal. Batista and Rey would then destroy Eminem and win the belts to set up this champions versus champion showdown on the pay-per-view. So, here we are. Tag team champs go to war. The brand battle continues. It seemed like it was over Survivor Series, but we rage on here. Nice. Batista and Rey are a fun team. They're really, really over. And, of course, much of this was done, too, to protect Batista because he was still nursing that injury from November. So they kind of hide him here in this tag match. Kane and Big Show, impressive despite being division killers. But you know what? It keeps him out of the main title for a bit. Batista continues his impressive presence. Big Show overpowers everyone early, showing it off, shoving Batista across the ring. Batista uses some shoulder blocks and a boot to come back. Big Show catches him and tags in Kane, but Batista fights through it until Kane hits a sidewalk slam. Batista catches Kane on the top of the slam and tags in Rey, who comes in and rocks Kane with leg drops. Ray sticks and moves, landing some tight shots until he gets caught on a springboard. Ray kicks Kane and sets up a 619, but Kane bails. Big Show slugs Ray from behind and spikes him on the floor before slamming him into the post. Big Show and Kane punish Ray and taunt Batista. Kane and Big Show double team until Batista makes a save and everything breaks down. Batista cleans house, spinebuster on Kane, and knocks Big Show to the floor. I thought this is kind of where we were going to wrap up. Batista and Big Show crash over the announce table. Ray hits a 619 on Kane, but gets caught during a West Coast pop and thrown to the mat, and then Kane chokeslams him for the win. Big vote of confidence for Kane and Big Show. To me, this was a really surprising finish. They kept Batista strong. He obviously didn't take the pin, and he also looked really good when he was on offense. I thought this could have went longer. I was surprised they cut it this short, especially considering all the bullshit we sat through. Kind of disappointing that it was only this long. It was a fun battle. I had a lot of star power. I thought it helped elevate Ray, put him on the same level as Batista. Batista still feels like a star. I thought Kane and Show looked pretty good too.
Yeah, it was. I remember us being a little skeptical at our seats of this match because I had thought all along there was really no need for them to win the belts. I wasn't upset that they did. I mean,
I'm curious where it may have been heading. Obviously, we know what happens later,
right?
And why things get cut short. But I'm curious if it was building to, we know what happens with Ray. What was Batista's role going to be in that? Is that was this building to like a match with them or something eventually? You know what I mean? Having them lose the titles and have issues, or having a friendly title match. I don't know what the deals were on that.
Right. No, I don't either. But I enjoyed the match. I thought it was a good, power match. I liked it, maybe a little more than I did. Than I did when we watched it the first time live. I mean, it was right up our alley. I mean, other than Ray, we had, three big power guys. So we were, big power moves and such. And I have to say, I know we're not talking about Raw's roster at the moment. We'll get more into that in the next vault. But I thought Kane Big Show as a tag team was really good. I mean, I thought it was very natural to have the two of them. They had nothing else going on. Almost had that, like, Bret Hart Canada feel in 97 because they were... Technically, they were baby faces on Raw, but they were heels crossing over to the blue brand. So that was kind of neat, interesting dynamic. Batista concludes his, 2005 with a solid pay-per-view performance. So now we ask the question, now that we're officially at this point. From January to December, who do you think had the better 2005, Batista or Cena?
I mean, Batista. He's got the better presence. He's over. To me, he's more the believable champion. Yeah, I'd say him. I mean, Cena's had his moments, but I think top to bottom, I mean, if you're ending this year, like, is who's the man, I'm picking Batista over Cena if I had to pick one of them.
Now, we'll obviously, 2006 ends up becoming a big year for Cena, and we'll obviously document it show by show. Even more than Batista, and obviously we'll see. We'll talk about what happened to him, but yeah, I mean, how could you? I mean, the guy settles in; he just acts and looks like the champion. He's comfortable in the role. He's not trying too hard. Yeah, I mean, everything worked out. I was pleasantly surprised watching it again today how good this match was in terms of just settling into good power guys. And Ray, one thing I loved about Ray at this time, Ray, which would change as he'd get older. But Ray knew how to bounce around like a pinball for the big dudes and make the match more entertaining because, his offense is fast. And when your offense is fast against a bigger guys, you make the match more exciting. And from a defensive perspective or as a face in peril, he always looks good throwing himself all over the place against guys like Kane and Big Show. And him eating the pin is not the worst thing in the world. It doesn't really matter. He's pretty bulletproof. But were you surprised Kane and Big Show won? I would have expected, the SmackDown guys to win on the SmackDown show. Were you surprised?
I'm never surprised when they win, and that includes current day. But
right.
I mean, they were the full-time team, and they were probably more going to be longer-term champions. So it kind of made sense, and they've been booking them really strong. I would have been more surprised if they pinned Batista. Like, them pinning Ray doesn't completely surprise me. No, I'm not too surprised.
Okay.
I would have been more shocked if Batista took the loss.
I would have been very surprised if Batista took the loss. Extremely surprised if he ate the pin.
But obviously. That said, I think it's a good spot for Ray. Like, he felt like a big deal with Batista out there. Like, mm-hmm. they feel like the top two faces on the on SmackDown right now, other than on Taker, obviously.
Right. And we'll get to him in a minute. But with Taker, he's like kind of in his own plateau, like right. kind of his own platform. So the red brand beats the blue brand in retaliation, kind of revenge for, maybe that's why they did it, because Raw lost at Survivor Series. True. Red Brain wanted to get their win back, so I don't know if that really made any difference. But so Kane and Big Show, your World Tag Team Champions. Of course, they won those belts back at Taboo Tuesday. They win the match here. And it was surprisingly fun. Just enough length. What was it?
It could have been
8.5. A little over 8.5. I mean, it could have been longer. Well, obviously, I mean, we've had a lot of garbage on this show that could have been eradicated. That match could have been maybe even 5 minutes more, maybe 15 minutes.
If you had 5 minutes of this, 5 minutes of the opener, maybe a couple of minutes of the tag match with M&M, like, you fill all that time. You don't need that bullshit.
Right, exactly. So the Red Brand Champions, your World Tag Team Champions, Kane and the Big Show, get the win over the WWE Tag Team Champions, which is your World Heavyweight Champion, Batista, mm-hmm. and Rey Mysterio. Final Taker Hell in a Cell last rites moment. And we go all the way back to the first moment. The first Hell in a Cell match, Bad Blood 1997, when, of course, he chucks Shawn Michaels off the cell wall onto that announce table. Which brings us to the main event, which has been pumped up all show long. As a matter of fact, we already talked about, as you mentioned, JR, earlier in the show, Randy Orton had already had his promo. So there you go. So we go right into the match.
Well, a little Sutton Fuel trivia for you.
Uh-oh.
Do you,
am I gutted?
No, but do you know at this point what number Hell in a Cell match this was? And how many are there total?
Didn't you just ask the same question twice? Two different ways?
No. What number this was? And then how many there have been total in history?
What number this is? Well, this is Taker's 7th, I think. And all told?
No. This would be his 6th here against Orton.
All told, I believe this is, let's see, 7... are we counting the Raws in 98?
I want all the total Hell in a Cells.
Okay. 1, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Bound by wild desire. I fell into a ring of fire.
10. This is the 10th one.
This is the 13th Hell in a Cell. Now,
13th.
Of course, we have to factor in Sutton math, so I'm not 100% sure. But
well, let me see. Bad Blood 97.
Think about it on your own time. So he's saying,
well, I mean,
he's saying that the one at WrestleMania this year will be the 33rd all time, and that this will be Undertaker's 13th coming up at Mania. And it was a 6th back in 05, 13th at the time. So if you want to scratch the math out at some point, you can go ahead and do that. But we're not going to kill any more dead air with that. With you mumbling to yourself. So.
Okay. In 1958,
I'm going to read the fun facts, so you can maybe take a minute. Feud continued on the special Tuesday SmackDown when the Ortons jumped Undertaker in the ring and Randy dropped him with an RKO and then loaded Taker into Eddie Guerrero's lowrider, which Rey Mysterio had driven to ringside. Randy drove it backwards into the set, causing an explosion. Later that week, on the regular edition of SmackDown, Orton demanded a title match in Armageddon, but before that challenge was addressed, Undertaker's voice boomed through the arena and told Orton that he'd be facing him inside Hell in a Cell. On 12-9, Orton declared he was tired of the mind games, but Taker kept torturing him throughout the night in some odd and hokey segments, kind of reminiscent of the old Ultimate Warrior Eric Bischoff ones, if you remember, like Taker was appearing in the mirror to only Orton and Cowboy Bob. Finally, on 12-16, Randy tried to back out of the match, but Teddy Long warned him against violating his contract. Randy tried to leave. Taker led Druids to the ring to block him in. A particular Druid raised the urn over his head and then cracked Taker in the head with it. He ripped off the hood, and it was Cowboy Bob. Randy dropped Taker with two RKOs, smashed him with a chair in the urn, and busted him open. And then Orton held Taker's bloody head by the hair and said he would see him at the pay-per-view. Now, following the show, Scott, it was leaked out that Cowboy Bob, who bled during the match quite a bit, mm-hmm. tested positive for hepatitis.
Ugh.
He actually had it as a teenager, but due to lack of symptoms, just assumed it was no longer an issue. Prior to the show, he was tested positive for it, but the results were never brought up, specifically by John Laurinaitis, the director of talent relations. I'm not sure exactly what his role was at that point. Once word got out, backstage officials and Undertaker were furious that Orton and Laurinaitis did not reveal the information before Bob bled all over the place during the match. This would be Orton's final pay-per-view. He was released in February. He was supposed to actually remain with Randy all throughout 06, which would have been awesome, but stupid is as stupid does, and this family always seems to find dumb things and ways to screw themselves up.
Yeah, pretty much.
So Cowboy Bob bled that hepatitis. That hepatitis.
For once.
It infected the Undertaker.
For once, we are not gutted. He is correct. This is the 13th Hell in a Cell match in WWE.
There you go.
History on. The first one, the second one ever at Armageddon. Of course, we mentioned the first
school
one.
School should start teaching Sutton math. Kind of like the, you know.
Kind of like your comic book makes just as much sense sometimes.
Yeah.
So there you go. And this is the first one in Providence. So, and I believe, though, there has been two in Texas, three in Pennsylvania, two in Philly, and one in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, man, Pam Anderson Lee. Hepatitis. Virgin-Z.
Virgin-Z.
Okay, here we go.
Okay.
Hell in a Cell. Main event, long time coming. Finally blowing this thing off. Started back in February. Lots of twists and turns. Cowboy Bob's out with Randy. Mashes the confidence in being trepidatious. I thought they did a nice job blending those two together. Taker had a pretty cool entrance, as always. Debuts the tights here, Scott. No more leather pants. Kind of done with the cowboy hybrid that started at WrestleMania 20 now. He's pretty much back full on to dead man
yep.
as far as the look goes. So he's back in the singlet and the tights. Orton dodges Taker early on, trying to set up the pace. Taker overpowers and mows through him methodically. Taker starts to punish Orton around ringside using the cage as a weapon. Taker works over the side, nasty spot where he yanks Orton hard side first into the ring post. Taker unloads a gross chair shot on the floor, sliced open. Taker wrecks him with a second one, just completely disgusting chair shots here. Taker chokes Orton with a chain and then javelins him into the cell as the blood just starts to pour out of Orton's head. Orton tries to use the stairs to come back, but Taker blocks it. Orton hits a desperate RKO that snaps Taker across the top rope and finally gets some offense in. Orton uses the steps in the cage to bust Taker open as well and then chokes him with a chain. Orton gets revenge with a big chair shot for a near fall. Taker makes a comeback but misses a leap from the top rope. Orton brings in the table but then spills to the floor. Cowboy Bob gets involved. He pulls Taker against the cell by his hair, reaching through the cage. Randy hammers away at him. Taker then yanks Cowboy into the cell repeatedly. And as he takes back over, Cowboy gets gashed. And that's when the hepatitis starts to flow. Orton power slams Taker into the cell, followed by a slugfest in the ring. Taker comes back again with his usual attack, capped by a choke slam. But Orton gets his foot on the rope. Orton hits a low blow with a chain, puts Taker on the table, and hits a nice splash through it. Orton slips out of the last ride, leads to a ref bump. Orton reverses a choke slam into an RKO, but there's no ref there to count. A new ref comes in. Cowboy sneaks in with the door open, yanks the ref out while counting after a last ride. Taker beats the piss out of Cowboy Bob on the floor using the cell. Orton reverses a tombstone and hits his own nasty-looking one as Taker lands funny but sits up during the cover. Taker pounds on the Ortons with the urn and then tombstones them both and picks up the win. I thought this was a pretty good cell match. There was a ton of blood, some sick weapon shots. Those chair shots are disgusting. It was a little long and a little drawn out, but I thought it was interesting enough. It blew off a long feud. And I thought a good gimmick match to close the year with. I like this. I think it's kind of a forgotten cell match in the canon.
I enjoy this match immensely. I thought it told a good story. I think that the psychology of it was that Orton was inexperienced in such matches. So most of the first maybe 10 or 11 minutes was Taker just having his way with him. And then Orton got an opening and then he started to work him over. So it was a very well told story. On pure talent versus experience. And there were some times, I would say, in the last 7-8 minutes of the match where I thought Orton was going to win.
Mm-hmm.
But
I don't know. It was pretty clear that it was the blow off. I mean, if Orton won, how do you have him win the feud like this? I mean, he's got his wins in. He won at SummerSlam. He won at No Mercy. I think it was pretty obvious. I thought this time around, the Taker was going to win the match.
Most likely. It just then I tell you, then they did a hell of a job at the end because there were a couple of times when we were there live. I thought maybe he'd sneak a crazy win in, but the match was very good. And Orton, Cowboy Bob with his gross eye bleeding aside, looked like Vader at Final Four. Like his whole left side of his face was bleeding and nothing else. So yeah, I enjoyed it a lot, and it was a feud that definitely saved Orton, because the beginning of the year, he's definitely one of the guys, maybe with Batista, that kind of got upticked from the beginning of the year to the end of the year in 2005. Because beginning of 2005, he was a disaster. He was a failed, failed baby face.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
In a nothing feud with Triple H.
Well, two things helped him. The heel turn and that injury that took him out for the summer. Because he came off some rub from that really good Mania match.
Yep.
And then he came back into ate up the whole second half of the year feuding with Taker, like reestablished. The stuff with his dad was really good.
Mm-hmm.
With him as a heel. It's been a big year for Orton. 2006 is a weird year for him, though. We'll see. A lot of ups and downs in the and out of the ring. So
yeah, no, a lot of it probably caused by his own stupidity, but we'll get into that. So there it is. The Undertaker wins the 13th Hell in a Cell match in WWE history, and one of the best. Another thing I noticed, on a side note, logistically, I remember sitting next to you and we were looking at the cell going down, and I said, "Does the cell look different to you?" I felt like the cell was smaller than.
You think so?
And now I went, that was my second cell match ever, because I went to Triple H and Foley at No Way Out 2000 in Hartford, and I felt like that cell was bigger, wider. This cell seemed narrower and taller. It might be just like, it might just be like a visual because of the formatics. Way the dunk is laid out. Plenty of visual formatics. Formatics, schematics, semantics. But it was a great match. It was great. I highly recommend it for those that haven't watched the show in a while. Jump on the network and watch it, because it was a pretty good cell match. It's very understated. Obviously, it was the second cell match of the year. This match was not better than Triple H and Batista, but it was good in its own merit. Considering who was in it, an experienced guy in the cell. Similar to, honestly, in that aspect, it's a lot like the first one, because Triple H was the experienced guy in the cell, and obviously Batista had never been in one. So psychologically, in terms of storytelling, both matches very similar in that aspect. But obviously Taker needed to do a little bit more to help Orton out, but he did a hell of a job, both guys. It was a great match. Highly recommend it. For those that haven't seen it in a while, it's a good match to watch.
Yeah, I thought the whole show was entertaining. The only thing, it really is hampered by that, by this the shit in the middle with the Tim White stuff and the Boogeyman and FBI stuff. I mean, if you hack that out and you give me just the matches, it's a pretty solid card, especially for December of 2005. Like, it's pretty good. It's a SmackDown, December SmackDown 2005, with a very thin roster. Like, I thought they cobbled together some pretty interesting matches, and they gave the big matches time. They gave the cell time. Benoit Booker got 20 minutes to tell their story, and both were really good. So, nothing bad on the show at all, match-wise. Like, I thought they really delivered in the ring. And coming off of this, you're kind of feeling okay about 2006. Like, even on the raw end, you have, Cena's done with the angle feud, but you still have Cena, you have Angle, you have Michaels, you have Edge. Like, you have some really good talent on Raw. SmackDown, you got Batista looking great on top, and, Rey's kind of seeming to be elevated a bit. Orton's coming off this good feud with Taker. So the roster as a whole seems like it's at a pretty solid spot leaving 2005.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see what happens as 2006 comes. But, heading out of here, you feel better than you probably did a year ago.
Yeah,
at
definitely.
The end of 2004, I mean, in many ways. And, it's been an interesting year. A lot of, pay-per-views overall were better than I remembered some of them being, especially in the middle stretch there in the summer and the spring, like Judgment Day and, those shows, Vengeance. And we knew Vengeance was good, but, Bash. Like, some of those shows were much better than I remembered them being.
Me too. Yeah.
We'll see if 2006 is the same way, because 2006, in my mind and my memory, is, like, potentially the worst year in company history. So, just from a purely quality standpoint.
Yeah. for a lot of reasons. It's one of the worst years. But we do get some historic debuts in 2006.
I just remember from a pay-per-view standpoint, it's...
Yeah, from a pay-per-view standpoint, it's pretty
awful. We'll see if that holds. I mean, we got a... Yeah. Was it like 14 shows or something to get through?
Yeah, it's the most jacked year. I mean, you got we debut extra show in January.
14 shows. Yeah, you get that. You get One Night Stand again, and then the ECW show in December. So yeah. A lot jammed into this year.
Two shows in June. Two shows in January. Two shows in June.
Two in December.
And two shows in December.
Two in and two in November, right? Cyber Sunday.
Yeah.
Or October, whatever, wherever it fell.
You know what? I just had the.
Either way, there's like 15 or 16 shows, so it's a, yeah. It's a pretty full year.
Here we go. List of pay per view events. 2006 has. 15. Yep, it's 15.
Okay, there you go. So, pretty full year that we'll be hacking our way through. So, all right, that'll do it for tonight. Thank you, as always, for listening, Scott. Main event this week?
Tomorrow night? Main event. It is the 50th episode, so for the first time in a while, the Core Four will return one show only, the four of them together, but it is the 50th episode, so we're going to do some, we'll do some fun stuff and talk about, you know, what's been going on, builds and such, but mostly we'll talk about some of the big moments in the history of the show as we are at the 50th episode of Main Event tomorrow, so it'll be a lot of fun.
We'll be back for our 398th episode of this show.
Yes, yes.
On Monday, like we had mentioned, is our sixth annual NCAA prediction show. We'll fill out a bracket. We'll open up the bracket group for PTB Nation to join in and compete against the experts from the show. And what we'll usually do is you all submit a bracket, and then we as a group fill out a bracket on the show. We go majority rules because there's five of us, and we'll fill out our bracket and see if you can top ours. And then, you know, we always come up with some kind of fun little prize that, you know, something easygoing, maybe an appearance on a show or, you know, join a main event episode or something like that. So We'll come up with something for you to do if you win the bracket contest. So keep your eyes peeled for that early next week. And then we're not sure about the rest of the schedule for the month. We know at some point we're going to do New Year's Revolution. We know at some point we're going to have episode 400, and we're hoping to get both of those in before the end of March. So stay tuned here as we continue to kind of build this ad hoc schedule through a pretty busy month, but we're trying to make up some of the shows that we've missed over the last year or so.
Yep.
All right, that'll do it. Check out PlaceNation.com each and every day. Keep supporting us. Amazon link on the right-hand side. I know you all shop at Amazon. Don't forget, click that damn link first. Help us out. You can keep the site up and running for free, as always. So, for my PSC Scott, I'm Justin. We're out. We'll talk to you next Monday with the Madness Brand. I want to see Rotella fall into the Ring of Fire. Any
Caribbean cruise. It's a Northern Caribbean cruise. Grey Goose.
His back hair lit on fire.
he's one of the few very flammable people.
That's very flammable. A lot of gas.
Yeah, flame retardant.
And the flames went higher. And it burns, burns, burns. The Ring of Fire. The Ring of Fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. Went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, burns, burns. The Ring of Fire, the Ring of Fire. The taste of love is sweet when hearts like ours meet. I feel for you like a child.